So our next speaker is Samuli Siltanen from the University of Helsinki, and he'll talk to us about low-dose three-dimensional X-ray imaging. And I think, from what you told me, those who have dental problems would be glad to have come to this talk.
Thank you. I should start by thanking Adrian Nachman and all the other organizers for this wonderful opportunity to speak to such an expert audience. So today I will tell you a story about an idea and wish to make low-dose X-ray imaging, and one way how this wish has come to be true. Let me mention, in Finland we have this Center of Excellence of Inverse Problems Research, and note how we cover the whole country with research groups of inverse problems mathematicians and physicists. This talk describes work done by a big group of people. It has been really a big effort, people from academia and also three companies, although the history is such that we started at Instrumentarium Imaging, a Finnish company that was bought by GE Healthcare, and later the dental imaging part was sold and became an own company called Palodex Group. But kind of the same people worked on the same problems in all of these three companies. And this is the structure of my talk today. First, I will tell you a little bit about this idea, what I mean by low-dose three-dimensional X-ray imaging and why it would be interesting. Then I'll show some first experiments we did on this, got encouraged. Then I go a little bit through the mathematics we've been using to solve these inverse problems. And then I'll describe a VT device for volumetric tomography, which is an X-ray device for dentists for planning dental implants. And then I'll show you some further ideas how to continue this work. Okay, the main driving force in this... So, there are situations when doctors really need to have three-dimensional information about the insides of a patient. This is one of such cases, of course, a pretty extreme one. And as you all know, we have a nice technology. We do have this excellent technology, Nobel Prize technology from the 70s, and later, of course, developed a lot and used in hospitals all around the world all the time, the X-ray, the celebrated computerized tomography based on the filtered back projection formula, first invented by Johan Radon in 1917 and later reinvented by Hounsfield and Cormack and developed into a wonderful technology that has saved so many lives and gives a really detailed image of the insides of a patient. But however, the form of this formula using the Radon transform based approach needs quite a comprehensive data set, so many angles where to take images. And today I'm talking about a different philosophy of imaging. As you know, the CT scan gives quite a substantial radiation dose, which is of course okay if the patient has a more serious condition compared to the possible cancer coming from the radiation. However, for more everyday things like dental implant planning and maybe three-dimensional mammography, for patients who we don't know yet do they have cancer or not, then it's not really appropriate to use a full CT scan. And the thinking behind this research is that with the filtered back projection based CT scans, doctors want really detailed information, and somehow the formula chosen for the computation dictates that we should sample the data with very fine angular steps. And that's okay, because then we get a really detailed picture. However, sometimes if we have not so serious situations, how about taking as few X-ray images as possible so that we still get a good enough reconstruction? In this thinking, we give as little radiation as possible, and then we use more involved mathematics and more computer power to take out or reconstruct a good enough reconstruction, not perfect necessarily, but good enough for the task in question. So this project was started in 2001. Actually, I started myself in 1999 to work at Instrumentarium Imaging after my PhD thesis. And there was just currently in the research and development a project to develop many three-dimensional X-ray imaging machines that would be based on any existing X-ray machine. So like this one is the dental panoramic machine. This is a mammography machine, and you see here is a degree of freedom. The breast is compressed between the plates. The X-ray source is here, and here is a degree of freedom. This can be moved plus minus 15 degrees, so a little bit limited angle data can be collected. And this is a surgical C-arm device used in operating theaters during surgical operations. And all of these machines can be moved so that they collect limited angle data from a little bit different directions. And we wanted to develop mathematical algorithms so that these machines become three-dimensional, so they can provide three-dimensional reconstructions of the patient. And how the projects went, there were several Finnish universities involved, people from them. Then, as I said, these three companies, GE bought Instrumentarium, I think, in beginning of 2003, and the Palodex Group, and also we had funding all the way from Finnish Technology Agency that specializes in funding projects that involve both industry and academia in Finland. And the starting point at Instrumentarium, how this all got started, was that they just, before I started at the company, they bought a license to Richard Weber's TACT patent. TACT stands for Tuned Aperture Computed Tomography. And Richard Weber works at, I think he's retired now, he worked at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, and he had these, in my view, ingenious ideas of doing very simple imaging, having some kind of specimen, putting one or more small metal balls there, then taking X-ray images from different directions, detecting the image of the ball, and using only that information, which pixel contains the image of the ball, then translating and summing the images digitally in a computer, he could kind of find sharp slices inside the specimen. This is mathematically, this is unfiltered back projection, usually from limited angle of view. And this idea of tomosynthesis, as it's often called, dates back to 1932. This is from a patent application of Tites Desplantes, where there is just a projection image of a plate with some iron wire numbers inside, and here's a tomosynthetic slice through it where the other depths have been blurred by wound. I believe Tites Desplantes used a gramophone to rotate specimens and plates, so he was a kind of inventor, early inventor in 3D X-ray imaging. Okay, so at the company we started to do experiments. This is one of our early experiments. I did with Ville Kolehmainen. Ville, could you wave a little bit? That's Ville. So by the two of us, we built this kind of an experiment. You see, here is the X-ray source. Here is our specimen. There is a platform we can rotate. As you see, this is not high-tech. This is just, we built this. Here is the detector taped to the wall using masking tape. And let me show you a more detailed image. Here is just one tooth. It's a wisdom tooth that was already removed from my friend Helena Sarlin, who provided this tooth, loaned it to me to use in research. I promised to return it to her. She insisted that I should. Of course, unfortunately, I lost it, but I always reassure her that this is one of the best documented teeth in the history of mankind. So here is the tooth. We can rotate it, and we can read off the angles from this note, the beautiful handwriting. This is our experiment. We rotated the tooth, but schematically we can think we rotate the X-ray source and the detector opposite. So we took images from all around half a circle to have the ground truth, and then we wanted to study what happens if we only use the data from these positions giving a limited angle of view. The projection images look like this from different directions. These are just a few of them just to show you the data. Here are the slices, and now I'm slicing the tooth. Let me just, so if the tooth is like this, We sliced it, we took 400 slices like this. This was approximately okay because the source was far away. So we sliced it, the tooth, this way. And this is through the crown. This is the ground truth. This is from the full angle data. This is a little bit higher. So here the palm chamber, which is translucent to X-rays. Here the roots start, and here are the three tips of the three roots. Two of them have grown together like this. So this is the truth. This is the tomosynthesis, which is also like the Weber's tact technique, unfiltered back projection. And these are from our Bayesian total variation approach. As you see, they are not very good. There is some kind of stretching in here, which is kind of natural because we know from microlocal analysis that if we have a jump on a circle like this and our source locations like this, we know from the work of Greenleaf and Uhlmann, later Quinto, Raman Katsevich, all based on the work of Victor Guillemin, that these parts of the boundary where we have a tangential X-ray and also other X-rays plus minus epsilon angle to them, if we have such data, we can see these parts of the boundary. But these parts are not represented stably in the data. And if we go back to the previous one, we see that actually, for example, here, this part of the boundary is visible. We see it quite nicely. But this boundary right here is completely blurred. So now, actually, we don't want to cut the tooth this way. We want to stack these 400 slices and cut it vertically. And what do we get then? We get slices like this. So now see, notice that even from limited angle data, so this is the truth, the ground truth, and this is from limited angle data. Same here, compare these. They are quite alike. And these are good enough for many clinical purposes, if we cut it the right way, that is. So we have this limited data, and we need to know the nature of the data, and we need to know the nature of the clinical task where the data is used. So this encouraged us a lot, so we continued our study. So we wanted to simulate this kind of chair-side intraoral imaging, and we did it by this system here. The reason why this head is upside down is because our tripod was broken. This is not the suggested method of measuring. So we taped, again, this kind of intraoral sensor inside the mouth. There's a human skull inside. This is a kind of regular head phantom. Here's the source. We moved it with Ville along some limited angle, took limited angle data. That looks, one of the pictures looks like this. This is a schematic picture. This is opening angle plus minus 30 degrees. Here's the detector, dental arc. We took 7 images. And in this problem, you see we have more than 42 million unknowns, 4 million data points. Fortunately, also in this case, we could divide this into a stack of two-dimensional problems, 400 of them again. So it was like 10,000 data points and 100,000 unknowns in each two-dimensional problem. So pretty big dimension in these problems. These are the slices through the teeth. This is the tomosynthetic approach that was back then studied in the dental journals. That's why we compare to that. And you can see, for example, this tooth here. This is one of the roots, and the two other roots are not visible here in this slice. And this is another slice, and this is another. So here, the two other roots are visible, and this root is not visible. So we could kind of differentiate nicely between the teeth. And for example, we could detect, think of as an application detecting alveolar disease, which is bone loss here inside. Sometimes it can be lost only somehow inside here between the teeth, so that one projection image is not enough to detect it. But from these kind of slices, we can detect it. And then I'd like to show you a slightly different technique. This is not Bayesian technique at all. This is a modified level set method. We had a knee phantom, so there was a human knee cast in some kind of hard substance, so it was kind of a human knee. So we took, with the surgical C-arm device, we took 60 projections from full angle, and we wanted to study what happens if we take fewer and fewer data points, but from full angle, but sparsely sampled. So we take fewer and fewer images. This is, as you may know, what happens with filtered back projection. It's not designed for this kind of data, so it breaks down and gives lots of this kind of streak artifacts. This is what happens with our level set approach. Of course, the quality goes worse. With 10 projections, we have kind of a suboptimal image, but still, I would say there are many things better in this image than in the filtered back projection. The trick in this level set thing is that unlike the usual level set method where you have a continuous function, like think of islands in the sea, if the sea is the zero level and there is the height of the ground, sometimes there are islands, sometimes the ground is below the sea level. Usually level set method is used as taking the shoreline, and inside the shoreline you have some constant, and outside the shoreline you have zero, the level of the sea. We tried that and noticed that actually the level set function itself looks like a reconstruction quite a lot. So we modified the level set method so that actually inside the level set here, we use the level set function itself, and outside it's zero. And actually this approach allowed us also to prove convergence for this modified level set method. Okay, so let me explain in a bit more detail how do we do this Bayesian inversion I described, or I showed the examples of. So let's quickly go through how to understand X-ray attenuation data. So let's make this very simple example experiment. Have an X-ray source here, here, and here, and send 1,000 photons towards a detector that counts how many photons come there. So here, ignoring noise for the time being, all the 1,000 photons come here. Here I chose this aluminum slab to be just the half thickness of this radiation, so half of the photons make it through. Here, 500 are left at this point, and again, half of them are gone, so this is 250. Then we take a logarithm of these numbers, and actually we want here to be zero attenuation, so we subtract these numbers from 6.9, so we get that here we have zero density, here we have something in unknown units, but we don't care. The point is that here we have double in the same unknown units. So with these two simple tricks, we can interpret detector data to give us line integrals through an attenuation coefficient. So then let's look at this very simple two-dimensional patient, square-shaped and consisting of 9 different tissues that are also square-shaped and homogeneous. Let's agree that the size of this small square is 1. So then we can interpret the X-ray measurement as being a weighted sum of these numbers. So 1 times 4 plus 1 times 4 plus 1 times 5 makes 13. And now if we take X-ray images from different directions, horizontally we get row sums, vertically another X-ray image we get column sums, and then diagonally, and as Pythagoras taught us, we have to add here the length of the diagonal, which is square root of 2. So here we have 3 X-ray images from this very simple patient, and this is the direct problem of X-ray tomography. If you know what's inside, we know what kind of X-ray images we get. The inverse problem is this. It's like a Sudoku puzzle. We are given these sums outside, which are the X-ray data, and we have to find matching numbers inside here. Of course, this is quite a simple example, but actually this is the true nature of tomographic problems. We don't think along those integrals and radon transforms. We actually really think along these discretized lines in this work. So in this case, we have 9 unknowns, 11 equations connecting them, so of course we can solve for them. But in these applications I'm talking about, we are often limited, especially in angle, or otherwise we have only sparse data. So typically we have less equations than unknowns. Of course, that gives some non-uniqueness and null space in the operator. For example, if we only have these two images, the horizontal projection and then these 3 diagonal X-ray measurements, we do have these 3 patients that give exactly the same X-ray images. Now, of course, we can see that this cannot be true because the X-rays would get stronger in this tissue, and that kind of tissue doesn't exist. But how to differentiate between these guys. Maybe this is too high, maybe we see there is no metal inside the patient, but this won't get us very far. We need a systematic way of incorporating some a priori information about the unknown, because the measurement information is not enough to specify the structure of the patient. So in this work, we continue, we give names to these pixels. So there are unknowns, vector X of unknowns, and vector M of the measurements. So we have this vector in R9, measurement vector in R6, and we have a matrix equation where the elements of this matrix contain lengths of paths of X-rays inside these pixels in the patient. So our measurement model is M, vector M equals matrix A times vector X, unknown vector X, plus some noise, and we assume that's Gaussian noise. We did some statistical studies that show that in our case, with the photon counts we get after the logarithm, this is actually quite a reasonable model. Not perfect, but I would say good enough model. So in the Bayesian approach, what we do is we understand, or we interpret both X and M as random vectors, and we want to find the conditional probability of X on the condition that we measured a measurement M. And we use Bayes formula. This here means that E equal up to a normalization constant. And this is a prior distribution giving high probability of vectors X that we somehow know a priori that look like dental tissue or whatever kind of tissue we're imaging. And this likelihood distribution is a probabilistic model of our measurement that actually looks like this. In this case of Gaussian noise, we have an exponential function. Here is the noise level, and here we have the discrepancy. So if you take any vector X, this A here takes virtual X-ray images of X, compares those to the measured X-ray images, and gives a probability like this. If these are very different, there's a big norm here, and the minus sign means that we get a very low probability. And the goal of Bayesian inversion is that typically in ill-posed problems, if the matrix A has a high condition number, the likelihood distribution is very elongated, and it's hard to use maybe just only maximum likelihood, because there might be even an infinite number of solutions, or at least there are many, many vectors that give numerically the same likelihood probability. So we would like to find a prior distribution that accurately describes our prior information and additionally is somehow orthogonal, or at least elongated in a different direction than the likelihood. Because then when we multiply these guys, the resulting posterior distribution is nice and localized. And from that posterior distribution, we draw some estimate that the doctor will then look at. We might find the vector giving the highest probability in the posterior. This argmax means we take the vector that gives the highest value to this function, or we could integrate for the mean value of the posterior distribution. Typically, this is an optimization problem, and this is a high-dimensional integration problem, usually solved by Monte Carlo integration. In this work, we actually, I'm now showing you only these maximum a posteriori estimates, so if you like, you can think of the results to be total variation regularized results, because the computation in this case is the same. So our prior distribution is positivity constraint, so we know there are no negative pixels, and we take the total variation penalty where we penalize neighboring pixels. But since we are working in a very high dimension, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of degrees of freedom, we actually smoothen out, this is a classical trick of smoothing out the absolute value function like this, so that we get a differentiable objective function in our optimization. Because in high dimensional optimizations, it's really good to have a gradient and use a gradient-based method. So this is what we use, so this is kind of approximate total variation. And we are solving this minimization problem, which is equivalent to total variation regularization, in this case the MAP estimate and the total variation regularization lead to the same computational problem. So we want to minimize this penalty functional this coming from the measurement, this coming from the prior information, and for non-negative pixel values. And what we do, we actually use a modify, at that point we actually implemented also this condition by some polynomials so that everything is differentiable, and we use the Barzilai-Borwein minimization method, which is known to work in very high dimensions. It's related to Euler's steepest descent, which is very slow, but this is not so slow, and the idea is that we always take a step to the direction of the negative gradient, but the step length is not the same as in Euler's steepest descent, where you do line minimization. Barzilai-Borwein doesn't do line minimization, but rather compute the step length from this simple formula containing only objects of the same dimension than x itself, so x and the gradient of the objective functional. So the dimensions are kept in check, there are no huge matrices to be stored, and this works pretty nicely, I would say. So next, let's see how this works in practice. We developed this method for actually many of these X-ray devices, but mainly due to these companies getting bought and sold, it turned out that actually the dental application was the one that we really took to the level of a commercial product. And here the idea is, if a person is missing a tooth, the dentist wants to put an artificial tooth, an implant there, and the idea is to drill a hole like this to attach a titanium screw that then will hold the artificial tooth. But inside the mandible of all of us goes a nerve tunnel containing nerves, and it's really important not to drill too deep, because then the nerve will be damaged, half of the face will be paralyzed, and this is really inconvenient for the dentist. Think of the lawsuits that follow. So this must be avoided at any cost. So this is, so the implants, the screws look like this. This is how they should be attached. And this hole should be deep enough to make it sturdy, but not too deep, as I said. And this, while it's of course important for people to get good implants, it really doesn't give permission to take a full traditional CT scan because of the high dose. So this is usually done, imaging, the 3D imaging needed for this kind of work is usually done by dental dedicated cone beam CTs. That's quite a nice way, it gives quite a detailed local tomographic reconstruction. They are usually based on filtered back projection, but as we will see, the dose is a bit high also in those. What we did was actually we took this panoramic device that was the starting point of the company in the first place, because it was actually a Finnish invention. This Yrjö Paatero worked in 50s at the University of Washington in Seattle. There was a race going on in the 50s to find an X-ray imaging method that would image all the teeth simultaneously. There were many kinds of inventions made, but Paatero's geometric invention then came out as a winner. The idea is that this machine with this C-arm here, there's an X-ray source here. Here is a slit-like detector. It used to be a film here that made a linear movement in this fashion. At the same time, when this rotates around the head, so the patient bites into a biting plate here, the head is between. This rotates, and there was a linear movement of the film as well. And what it did was it picked out a sharp layer through the whole dental arc, actually based on the same idea of tomosynthesis that was discussed also previously, but based on an ingenious geometric movement that picks out the correct curve. And it's a standard equipment. Actually, Paatero came to Finland, founded a company called Palomix, in the late 60s, and in the halfway of 70s, these devices became widely distributed in dental clinics. And what we did now, in this project, we reprogrammed this machine to move in a different way and made use of the fact that here there is a slit detector that's actually electronically, the linear movement of the film is is implemented by an electronic movement of pixels in a very narrow detector. So we move the machine in a different way, like a Xerox machine or scanner, so that this slit detector moves like this. The X-ray focus stays in a roughly fixed position, and we can record this kind of limited angle data along the dental arc. So these are the pictures, how they look like. They look like this. And we have plus minus 20 degrees limited angle of view. And typically we take 11 projections with these machines, and it's 1 million pixels, 1 megapixel image each. So then, using these limited, or these sparse data methods developed in this project, we can make this kind of three-dimensional cut through the mandible. And here you can see the nerve tunnel. Here is the top of the bone. So this is the length that should be drilled with no problems whatsoever. The computation became quite heavy because this is a genuine three-dimensional problem. It cannot be divided into two-dimensional subproblems. And we had more than 7 million degrees of freedom and something like 2 million data points in this problem. In the end, what we did in the project, we built this kind of Linux cluster with 13 machines and used graphics processing units to make fast projections and back projections to put the computation time to under 4 minutes. And now it's really a product. It's been sold for 4 years by the Palodex group. You can find more information if you want on their marketing webpage. It looks like this. They give all kinds of information about it, and they said they've sold thousands of units already. And actually a student of mine came to discuss about the master's thesis, and it turned out that she had been a couple of days before in this kind of volumetric tomography imaging, which was, I would say, really nice to hear. And I think the main point here is that the doctors already, the dentists, they already have the panoramic machine at their clinic. What we do is we just update the software. And the core is really mathematics. Of course, there are the new movements, but this sparse data reconstruction is the core. So the existing two-dimensional machine becomes a tomographic machine by a software update only. And I promised to you that this would be low dose imaging. So here's a study comparing different cone beam CT. So this is actual traditional CT of the head. These three are dental-dedicated cone beam tomographic machines that rotate around the head. And this volumetric tomography is known to give roughly the dose of 1 to 2 panoramic images. So panoramic image is about 6 microsieverts, and the VT device is between 6 and 12, the dose. So as you can see, it's lower dose than any other approach to this problem. All right, and then let's see some future developments planned. This is actually something we already published. I don't think it's in the commercial machine yet. Oh, let me, Nuutti, can you wave a little bit? Nuutti is the guy who put lots of effort into this project. And here the idea is that we have these limited angle projection images, and at the same time, from the same patient, we also record the panoramic image, which helps because these are from limited angle, and this image actually is taken from 90 degree angle compared to those. Although it's not a projection image, it's a tomosynthetic slice. But we combined them in our Bayesian approach and found this kind of, these are navigation images, this is where to measure, and you can see here kind of the shadows of the teeth, which you cannot actually see in the product, so we hope this will be an update to the product someday. Okay, then some other things we are working on. We would like to start to use wavelet-based prior distributions instead of the total variation prior. I'll tell you about the reason in a minute. Let's first see, so these are wavelets. Wavelet transform divides this kind of image into small-scale details, horizontal, diagonal, vertical, then the next bigger details, next bigger, and then the low pass part. So there are these wavelet, this is the tensor product construction there are wavelet basis functions living there. Let me number all these basis functions with one index only, with L, starting from the low frequency one and then going from coarse scale up to the fine scale in some way, which is not so important how it's really done, but from coarse to fine. So then we can describe functions as expanded in the wavelet basis, and we can look at the Biesov space norms. I think it's, well, Biesov spaces are spaces with certain kinds of weak differentiability properties, but the main point, I think, is that we can compute these norms using just the wavelet coefficients, or the absolute values of the wavelet coefficients. It's really fast to compute wavelet coefficients, so this is computationally quite a simple thing to compute. Especially interesting is the Biesov space with one derivative and integrable with P1 and Q1, because this space is related to the integral of the absolute value of the first derivative in a bit generalized sense, but it's closely related to total variation, and in two-dimensional problems it's so easy to compute. It's just a sum of absolute values of the coefficients. So if you want to do a prior distribution based on wavelets and Biesov space norms, actually what we have, this is the likelihood part in our posterior distribution, and then the prior takes this very simple form we are just having here. We need to sample from this kind of distribution, e to the power of absolute value of the unknown. So computationally this is nice, and theoretically there is also a reason to use these. Namely, now generally in inverse problems solution methods, we have some kind of measurement. Here we have 8 pixels, which is the k is the number of measurement points, and then we pixelate the unknown in the way we want. Independently, my point is that how many pixels are here is independent from the number of the pixels in the detectors. We can, if we want to compute with more accuracy, we can increase these. Also, we can buy a new detector with more pixels, or maybe we can measure from a new angle altogether. So these numbers of data points and numbers of unknowns in our representation of the reconstruction is independent. And now what happens with total variation prior in the Bayesian use, not in the regularization use, but in the Bayesian use, there are some problems when the discretization is taken into infinity. With Biesov priors, there is no such problem. There is really a well-defined continuum limit case that can be approached by discretizing more and more finely. With total variation, with the Bayesian use, there are some problems with that. And with in our group, we think that inverse problems, including the Bayesian approach, should have theorems like you know, in finite elements and other numerical methods, you have these theorems saying that if you discretize more finely, put more computational effort, you would get a more accurate result. This should be a basic thing, but I think it hasn't been studied so thoroughly in the field of inverse problems yet. So we, in this work, we provided such understanding for statistical inversion with Biesov space priors, because they really allow a continuous limit case that is well defined. So we know that when we compute with more and more accuracy, at least we are computing the same limit estimate with more and more accuracy. Then it's a different thing if our prior information is correct or not. The estimate may be good or bad, nevertheless, but there is some kind of consistency with discretizations anyway. This is the thing what happens with total variation with its Bayesian use. If we use a fixed parameter giving the weight between the likelihood and prior, the mean estimates diverge, but the MAP estimates, which this is also equivalent to total variation regularization, it works fine with discretizations. So here are many reconstructions plotted with discretizations going from 64 points up to more than 8,000 points, and we see that these estimates converge nicely. But the mean estimates don't, and we can make the mean estimates converge by choosing the scaling parameter like this, depending on the discretization level n. However, then the total variation prior becomes a Gaussian smoothness prior at the limit, which is not what we want. We want edge preservation. This is lost at the limit, not good. And on the other hand, also, if we use this choice, the MAP estimates convert to zero, so they are useless at the infinite limit. So there's something strange with the total variation in the Bayesian context, not in the regularization context. All right, so let's look at a couple of applications of these Biesov space priors. This is with limited angle tomography for mammographic imaging. This is a tomosynthetic slice that actually some people are still doing research on. I would recommend to everybody to move to the Biesov space-based approach because we get a lot more contrast and detail in the limited angle reconstruction. This is a local tomography experiment with real data. We had a dry mandible. We imaged from different directions. So this is the region of interest, and outside there is stuff that is attenuating, but it's not seen in every projection image. So here we used all the detailed wavelets everywhere, so it's a really quite big problem. And in this case, we used only the coarse wavelets outside the region of interest, and we used the Biesov space prior. So it seems that in the region of interest, we still get a nice reconstruction, and we can reduce the decrease of freedom by one order of magnitude. Let's take a closer look. This is the previous region of interest from the using the coarse wavelets outside, and this is the lambda tomographic reconstruction from exactly the same data. So it's quite sparsely sampled, so lambda tomography, it's not at its best in this case. This is a comparison. And let me show you my future dream. Now that we have shown that it is possible to make reasonable reconstructions from projections only from few different directions, then why not build a machine like this? Let's put X-ray sources, several of them, in a fixed position, each of them having their own detector, also in a fixed position, and capable of recording many frames per second, maybe 20, maybe 400. They are already commercial products. So there's no moving parts in this construction. In here, maybe there can be a beating human heart. Maybe there is angiography. We put contrast agent in the blood flow, and we can do a three-dimensional reconstruction with time resolution. So it's kind of a four-dimensional tomography. So we are moving on to simulate data from this kind of a construction and hopefully building a prototype in the near future. And if anyone is interested in this approach, maybe wants to collaborate or kind of wants to suggest some nice applications, please come to talk to me. I'm very excited about this stuff. And to conclude, I would say that it is possible in many cases to use only very few X-ray images to make good enough three-dimensional reconstructions. However, we need different mathematical methods than filtered back projection. We need to develop some tailored approaches to work with such sparse data. Thank you very much for your attention.